Happy New Year and welcome to the Pocket Gamer Podcast. It is episode number 425, the first of 2018, a brand new start. Not really, it's just a continuation of an ongoing story that is your life. I am the sage James Gilmore. And joining me to bring us into the new year, it's only Emily Bloody Soden.
I'm still here. You can't get rid of me that easily.
You say that every time, and I guess it gets truer every time you say it.
Exactly.
I suppose.
That's just becoming more and more apparent.
Yeah, isn't it, though? So we're back. We hope that you guys had a cracking Christmas / Yuletide / holiday season and enjoyed the new year and didn't get too bleary, or just did and are feeling better now. What did you do? Did you have a good holiday? Was it nice? Did you get toys and games and that?
Yes. Yes.
I haven't actually asked you if you got Christmassy stuff. We're all too old and cool now to discuss what you get for Christmas, but what'd you get for Christmas?
Yeah, well, to be honest, I think you reach a certain point in your life and then actually getting socks for Christmas turns out to be a good thing.
Actually useful.
Yeah, they're actually useful. So I got some socks and some under eye stuff because I'm getting old.
Under eye stuff.
Yeah, I got Skyrim though. That was childish of me.
Oh.
And I actually bought that for myself and gave it to my parents to wrap for me.
Kicking ass on the Switch in the land of Skyrim. Oh, actually, is it? Is it on the Switch?
Yeah, it's on the Switch. And it's not bad, okay. Actually. Like, because I've played it to death on the PC anyway.
Right.
But it's nice, actually, to have it on a system that you can literally take with you everywhere.
Yeah, that's what everybody's... I can't justify it for a time input, you know what I mean? Like, I did actually play it a bit when I got a PC that was initially capable of doing it, and I played it for a little while and I sort of tapped out in that way I do with a lot of the Bethesda big open world doodads.
It's more about the lore, isn't it?
Yeah, because it's quite contained, Skyrim, isn't it? It's just like one location of it being old and snowy and Viking. It's kind of just that one region where everything kind of looks the same.
Yeah, well, and also it's like even if you consider everything as one map, you know, same as Breath of the Wild, where you can run from one side of the map to the other. Mm. But there's so many different side quests in, like, The Witcher and Breath of the Wild and games like that, that is totally lacking in Skyrim. Like, it feels like there should be lots to do in it, but realistically, the worst you're going to get is you're going to run into an Emily. Emily.
I don't want to run into one of those. They're no, a nightmare. Can't get rid of them, apparently.
No. Is to run into an enemy and have to kill it. That's about as far as you get.
Okay. It is a testament to the way things have gone and the way 2018 is going to go that we are now talking about Skyrim as a mobile game.
Mm, yeah.
I think, you know, that is a really interesting turn we've had in the last couple of years where, yes, Skyrim, albeit from a game from 2011, is a mobile title now, and that's the way it's going to go. So look forward to that. And our newsy bits and bobs for this week. So we're going to talk about your soon-to-be-exploited Intel CPU. Don't worry, it's just a massive, massive like hole in your system security on every single handset. It's fine, it's good, don't worry. We'll talk about new games that are coming up in 2018, stuff to look forward to, along with reviews of Anti-Hero. We're going to talk about Max, The Curse of the Brotherhood, and a little look at Sharado on the App Store. Plus, we talk to Mike Bithell, he of Thomas Was Alone fame, to discuss Subsurface Circular, which came out late last year, and how he brought it to iPad and the other short games he's going to be making this year. But first, the news. There's a hole in your phone and all the bad things are going to get in. And I'm not talking about the mouthpiece microphone. No! So, traditionally, iOS devices have always been those ones where people have gone like, nobody really hacks them. It was the same thing with Macs for a long time when they said that there are so many bugs that you can exploit in the Windows operating system. And for the longest time, it was like, well, just get a Mac because you just don't get viruses on a Mac. Because people didn't bother it because it wasn't the predominant system. I don't think that's quite as true nowadays. And it's even less true now. So they revealed that there are two, I guess what they call security flaws, in every device that has an ARM or Intel chip in it. Which sounds bad, and I probably is bad, actually.
I was going to say, I think that's most devices, isn't it? Most modern devices within the last 20 years or something, I heard.
Exactly. So, yeah, Intel, ARM, and AMD discovered gaps in their security system, in the CPUs. Apple had been very quiet about it for a while, and they did reveal this week that actually, yes, Mac and iOS devices are affected by these exploits. Sorry about that. Now, it sounds very bad, but don't actually panic that much, because the exploits, which are referred to as the Spectre exploit and the Meltdown exploit, both of which do slightly different things, on their own, they're not going to do you any damage. It's only if you download a bit of horrible spamware and then open it up, and then maybe you'll be in trouble.
Yeah, something there. Because the weird thing is, like, I was reading up when I was doing my research for the article this morning. Apparently, they've known about this breach for like 6 months.
Yeah, so they've been quiet for quite a while on it.
As per usual, I suppose.
Apple are notoriously tight-lipped when it comes to this kind of stuff, and they don't want to talk about things that are going to make their system sound less than secure. The background stuff is a bit technical, but to give you the full details, the Meltdown and Spectre issues, and I can quote directly from the Apple support page here, take advantage of a modern CPU performance feature called speculative execution, which improves speed by operating on multiple instructions at once, potentially in a different order than when they're entered into the CPU. The broad sweep of this is that the exploitation from the Meltdown and Spectre thing abuse speculative execution to access privileged memory, including that of the kernel, from a less privileged user process. So it can get access to your memory systems. So presumably, potentially also your information or data you have stored on there, which is obviously bad. But as we say, unless you've downloaded another thing to go with it, then it doesn't actually have any effect on you. They are obviously working to fix the loophole, and they put out a little thing. They're saying that since exploiting these issues requires a malicious app, we recommend downloading software only from trusted sources, and obviously they're working on it at the moment. So it sounds bad. It's possibly not as bad as you think it is, but you know, it's not great either.
No, it is fine. Just stay off the porn, James.
What? What did you go... Are you straight there and straight to me? How very... accurate. no, dare you! Dare you! So, just, yeah, be a bit wary. But that just goes... This is basically just a common sense thing of, like, don't download random stuff at all, ever. Don't download anything from untrusted sources. If you sideload apps because you've jailbroken your device, then, you know, on your own head be it. So... Just be sensible, and we'll keep you informed as and when they fix it. But I guess we're all in the same boat because everything runs on these chips. So great, great news. Great news there. Additional bad news, kicking into 2018 and into 2019, is that Nintendo has delayed the launch of 64GB game cards from this year, which apparently they were supposed to appear in, to next year. Now, this is problematic from a development point of view, I think, because, as I understand it, the maximum capacity for the game carts that you buy are 32 gig, right?
Yeah.
So Breath of the Wild sits on a 32 gig card comfortably, but then I assume the DLC is then downloaded onto external SD cards and all that if they need to add content later.
Yeah, well, I'm surprised that they managed to fit Breath of the Wild onto 16 gigabytes.
In it, though. Because, I mean, then I guess it's only 720, so maybe. But, like, yeah, they've done a good job cramming it onto that size. Now, the upgrade to allow developers to put games that are up to 64 gig onto the cards, I think it's one of those things that feels like more of a problem for ports of console games that come onto the Switch.
Mm. Yeah.
Because I know that Doom had a few issues with cramming stuff into a reasonable size, to the point where you can download the game without multiplayer, and then you download the multiplayer, and that's another sort of 10 gig that doubles the size of the game and all of that. So when it comes to these direct ports, and we're going to see more of them in the future, and presumably we're going to see more of the day and date style releases, where a game comes out on PS4, Xbox, and Switch, and PC, you know, all at the same time. And when you are dealing with console, you've got, 50 gig and upwards to play with on a disc.
Yeah. Yeah, so the whole process of trying to fit, you know, one of these big blockbuster games, because we know that it's going to be supported from Switch now that the Switch is such a success.
Mm.
Trying to fit, you know, a 54 onto a 32 gig game card is going to be harder and harder, actually, as the ports get more advanced.
Yeah, as the games continue to grow in size and complexity. I mean, I guess there's always going to be some downscaling anyway, because you don't need to support 4K and never will for a Switch, so that's a big chunk of assets that don't need to be downloaded right there. Forget the 4K resolution textures, don't need any of them. So there is stuff you can cut, but it just, I imagine, gives developers a little bit less wiggle room than perhaps they were hoping for this year. 720p textures for the win. But good news 2018, we wanted to mention a few things that we are looking forward to that are going to be coming out in the next few months / year. So top of my list, and many people's lists, I think, is The Room sequel. It's yes. called The Room Old Sins. And as we understand it, it's kind of... they're going to start a different story in the same way that, like, the first series was basically a trilogy with a little insert chapter in the middle. Apparently this is, from what I've heard, going to go back to roots. I think it's going to be something of a reboot or almost prequel.
Yeah. The devs were talking about it last year, and we're just like, yeah, it's going to be pretty much more of the same, but done slightly better. As in, like, different story, but same mechanics, different puzzles, things like that, you know?
Yeah, I don't think they're going to radically shift, because, I mean, from what they do where they add, like, an extra mechanic in, a different type of lens that allows you to view a different type of information etched into the side of all of the boxes. But apart from that, I don't think they're going to meddle too much with the actual gameplay, because it's fairly rock solid.
Yeah, well, don't fix what isn't broken, you know?
Yeah. I mean, the first game was just that one room, that one box. The second game was like, all right, then we've got several boxes so you can move around the room. And then the third game was like, we can move into different rooms and find different boxes. So we just kind of broadened the scope every time. So they've kind of gone everywhere they can go, really. But I'm still looking forward to it, because I don't find that that gameplay gets tedious. I still find those games just a joy to play.
Yeah, yeah. I think they're just going to put more into the story this time.
Yeah, expand the plot and the mythos and whatnot.
Yeah, there you just go. The puzzle. That's a much more literate way of saying it.
I just use a nice word. Mythos is a nice word, and it makes you sound good.
Yeah, it is a nice word, actually. I was just there like, oh, yeah. It makes you sound much smarter.
The nice thing about this one is that it's coming soon. So the date is 25th of this month. So we get some room in basically 2 weeks. And I am extraordinarily hyped for it and hope it's going to be great. And I'm pretty much sure it will be. They haven't released a bad one. Other games that have got great pedigree and look fantastic and should hopefully continue their streak of lushness into this year's The Alto Thing. So we had Alto's Adventure, and we've been waiting for Alto's Odyssey for quite some time.
Mm-hmm.
Some of us may have even played it.
Maybe. We can't confirm or deny.
And it's going to be this year. They haven't given us a date. We've seen artwork, we've seen trailers, and we're excited because that first game is elegant simplicity.
Yeah, and they've got that new wall-running mechanic, don't they?
Oh, yes, that's right. Good point. Has that been publicly revealed?
Yeah, that was revealed at Gamescom last year, I want to say.
Okay, good.
They showed some footage of it.
All right,
in action. Splendid. Don't worry. I'm not like
just checking. No, that's great news, and the first one's lovely, and basically is king of the kind of cool auto-runner, side-scrolly, auto either slider, surfer, skier, whatever you want to call it. But it's cracking, and the new one looks beautiful, and I think we can expect good things from it. Personally, I'm hype at the announcement of a new Kingdom Rush.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. No, this has been coming for ages as well, hasn't it?
It has. Well, it got waylaid slightly because I Marines came out, which was another game that was we saw like in 2015 before came out last year.
That was before my time.
Yeah, I know, right? So they do spend a healthy amount of time knocking these things up, and it goes some way to explaining why they're so polished and awesome when they do come out.
Yeah,
because
we were
playing like a fully working version of Iron Marines 2 years before it came out.
Mm.
So, and we've got video of it, actually, and like some stuff's changed, but obviously they were just ironing out those kinks for ages.
Detail, isn't it? And it goes to show in its reviews and its response. And I still remember writing about Kingdom Rush 4, and the response from, you know, readers and things like that was ridiculous.
Yeah, the cult fan base for this one, and I think it, you know, it's beyond a cult, I think it sells really, really well, but the fan base is passionate, because it is just, for my money, the best tower defense franchise on mobile.
Yeah.
It's really good, and fun, and charming, and clever, and great. So, fourth one, I mean, they've iterated, it hasn't been great differences each time, it's kind of been more of the same with Kingdom Rush Origins and Kingdom Rush Frontier, I think it is.
Mm.
I expect it'll be more of the same, but I don't care. I want to play more of those levels. I think it's a lovely game, and let's have more of that, please. But yeah, there's some other things. There's a full article, actually, you can go and read with some more games on PG. But there's plenty to look forward to this year, and we're excited to get stuck right in. Mike Bithell appeared on the scene with Thomas Was Alone, an indie game that broke through in a big way, leading to multiple awards and a long-running career, leading to the likes of Volume and Earthshape, a VR game that was developed for Google... I forget what it's called now. Google Daydream.
Google Daydream.
That's what I'm looking for. As you can hear, Mike is with us today to talk about Subsurface Circular, which appeared on iPads late last year. How are you doing, Mike?
I'm fantastic. I did just get a Nando's for lunch, and the chips were colder than I'd hoped. But other than that,
oh,
it's all going pretty well. Yeah, no, I mean, I was disappointing, but I'm...
It's not the way to start 2018, is it? Jeez. Good holiday and all that?
Yeah, it was lovely. Yeah. Saw family, friends, all that stuff. But yeah, no, it was really nice. Really nice. And weirdly got quite a bit of work done as well, which is not healthy, but productive.
I was going to ask, because looking back at the resume, you do seem to like not shy away from the work stuff and have a lot of projects going on, or certainly be flitting between a number of different ones. You don't tend to stay in one place for too long.
I tend to bounce around, and obviously as well, I've got a fantastic team who are doing stuff as well, although they don't work over Christmas. So it's weird. Christmas is this weird kind of period where for me, I can actually kind of get some work done. Which again is completely unhealthy and terrible advice for anyone who's listening.
Is that a change of environment though? Do you go to a different place and like see family, and it's a nice...
It's partly that. I got in trouble once because I said on a podcast much like this, I said that I used writing to avoid my mother-in-law. Little did I know that she somehow heard that podcast.
Oh man.
And I was in trouble for a good, I'd say about a year that lasted. But that's fine. It's all good now.
Well, as long as you use that experience as raw material for your next narrative, then it's all been worth it.
If there's one thing the world needs, it's another mother-in-law joke in a video game.
Good lord.
That's what the medium needs, I think. I think the future kind of perspective, yeah.
Well, I suppose it beats the long-running daddy issues trope, which seems to go through almost everything. However, narrative's a big part of your game. Just
excellent
looking back
segue.
At
excellent.
I thought so. Smooth, right? Yeah. Looking at all of them, whether the few things that seem to be commonalities between your games is whether they're platformers or like top-down stealth games or whatever it might be, is you like puzzles, it seems, and you do like narrative. You do like bringing those two things together. In Thomas Was Alone, it was very much sort of hand in hand. You know, in some games where you'll have the narrative will be a separate thing in a cutscene, and then you move to the game. In Thomas Was Alone, it's kind of happening as you go through with Daniel Wallace doing this narration over the top. Why narrative and puzzles? Why are you not making driving games or straight up first person shooters?
I think because I don't think I'd be very good at it, is the honest answer. I think a big part of you know, you obviously always want to stretch yourself when you're doing creative work. You want to be kind of pushing outside your comfort zone, which is why I do jump genres a bit, and we tend to up the scale of production each time, which is fun. But at the same time, I think you do have to play to your strengths. And I did work on a third person shooter once, but I was a very low ranking team member on that, and I've never done a racing game. I think where my skill lies is the storytelling side. People seem to like that stuff. Puzzles, I like. They're also just a really kind of a very gaming specific thing. There's a very specific set of puzzles that you can't really do outside of a video game context. And that's interesting to me to do work that I feel kind of can't exist anywhere else. And often puzzles kind of tie in quite well with story, which was what the new game was very much about, was just finding ways to link that stuff up. So I think it's about playing to the strengths. And I think, puzzles are just a really nice gaming trope that I do tend to lean on quite a lot.
Well, there's something about revelations. I mean, in both the narrative and a puzzle context, like good puzzles are those things where you finally figure something out and go, ah.
It's like telling a good joke, right? It's that thing of it's the expectation versus outcome. Yeah, absolutely.
And you get that moment of kind of like, and it either makes you feel like a genius or an idiot, depending on how long you've been spending doing it. And narrative stuff can give you these wonderful, like, moments, and that kind of, I guess they go hand in hand some way.
Well, we like to be surprised. We like to learn and we like to be surprised, yeah. Absolutely.
Absolutely. Although another commonality I've noticed is using very British voice actors speaking very Britishly. From whether it's Danny Wallace or Sue Perkins or whoever it might be.
Yeah.
Is that just they happen to be nearby? Is that a British dev thing? Or just like the sound of it?
I just was walking down the street. I saw Danny Wallace one day. No. with Danny, it was specifically, with Thomas Was Alone, I wrote it and kind of was intentionally writing it in kind of a Douglas Adams-y way. But one of the things I did from a research point of view was I listened to a lot of Danny Wallace audiobooks, because he's a really good writer. And he always reads his own audiobooks. And I was kind of writing in a style that was, I wouldn't say I was plagiarizing Danny Wallace, but I was definitely leaning towards his voice. So when I tried to find a voice actor to read those lines, I kind of failed several times to try and find someone who could do a pretty good Danny Wallace impression. And I think it happened on Twitter. I think I just tweeted, like, "Hey, Danny Wallace, you're gonna be in my game." And I guess I caught him at a moment where he was looking at his Twitter, and it kind of came together. With Sue, it was specifically the Sue thing. It was that she's in Earth Shape and she's brilliant. I want to work with her again. It was the night that the Brexit vote came in, and I was, you know, it didn't go the way I would have preferred. So I was feeling a bit mopey, and my business partner Alexander, who's an American, sent me like, you need to watch the British Bake Off. And it was like, you know, obviously everyone but me on the planet had watched it at that point. And I just binged for, I think, 6 episodes British Bake Off.
Really?
And I just, the main takeaway from that was, one, you know, I wanted cakes. And two, Sue Perkins, I think, is just such a warm and brilliant personality. And for the game that Earthshape was, it was kind of this gardening, kind of quite chilled out puzzle game. She was just a perfect kind of match for it. But she's got great range. She's a brilliant comedian as well, which everyone always forgets now. She's a great presenter. People forget she's also got great comedy chops. And a massive gamer. Proper nerd.
Although, one thing, to bring it to Subsurface Circular, this is one of the first games with no voiceover. This is exclusively a text adventure. I imagine this is something to do with the fact that you've presented this as one of a series of shorts, is that right, you're going to be working on?
That's right, yeah. It was a specifically kind of an experimental thing that we did, because basically we had a bunch of time. We were waiting on a contract. And we had, you know, a chunk of time we needed to use up. And I'd always wanted to do kind of branching stuff. The stories in the previous games are all very linear and straightforward. But to be honest, with the voiceover question, it was actually more to do with ambiguity. One of the things Subsurface Circular does, I think, pretty well is it has these kind of choices and these moments where you can decide how you interact with characters. And because it's text, you actually read a lot more personality and a lot more changeability into the personality of the characters as a result. So, like, for example, there's a character who asks for your help, and then you can help them or you can't help them, and then at the end of that sequence they say, "Oh, and thanks so much for the help." And if you're playing that game and you did help them, then you read that as a sincere and lovely acknowledgement of the work you've done. And if you didn't help them, then you read that as sarcasm. And that's kind of a really interesting thing with text-based games, is you can actually use the ambiguity of language, and kind of specifically the English language, and how it reads differently based on the context going into it, to actually get stuff that feels, you know, much more reactive to what you're doing. It's kind of a magic trick. You're lying to the player almost. You're kind of creating this illusion that there's more going on than there is. And with voiceover, it would become very tricky to kind of stitch stuff together and create a similar experience. You'd have to get actors to read lines over and over again, which, you know, lots of games do. But I think with Subsurface, it made sense to do it text-based.
There's also the element of the fact that you're talking to machines, essentially.
Absolutely. Yeah, they would have ended up with like a terrible kind of text-to-speech voiceover. Yeah, that wouldn't have worked so well.
And also fits nicely, because the idea of it being almost harking back to those classic 80s text adventures where you are literally just sort of, you know, typing to the computer and you're getting string text responses, you know, that you will always end up reading in your own voice in your head.
It does mean that Subsurface feels a lot faster, weirdly, than I think it would if it was voiceover. It feels a lot more, it moves at the speed that you're reading it and you're thinking about it. And I think that leads to a more responsive and good feeling experience. Doesn't mean it can't be done with voiceover, but it was just another kind of benefit we got out of doing it with text. So it felt like the right choice, I think.
Which also lends itself, one of many things that lends it to touchscreens and to the iPad versions, because you can't necessarily guarantee people will have their volume up when they're playing on an iPad or an iPhone or something. So having it entirely be interactive means people can play it out in public or, you know, on a lunch break or something without disturbing the peace. You put it onto iPads specifically. I imagine this kind of game actually wasn't as tricky to port over as some might be. I'm only guessing, but with things like that UI system where you can just kind of tap options, was there much work you had to do to translate the UI to work on a touchscreen, or was it quite natural?
So it is very, I mean, on PC, it's a point and click with the mouse. You don't use the keyboard at all. It's literally got like an on-screen pause button, so we don't even, you know, use escape key like you would on a PC game normally. So from a technical perspective, it was, yeah, very straightforward to kind of take the same idea and make it work on iPad. Where the challenge was, and one of the things we talked kind of with Apple a lot about as we were doing it, was making sure that the kind of that the experience felt good on the iPad, and that it also was responsive and felt like it was using the technology. So things right. like making sure that, you know, as you tilt the iPad, you get this kind of subtle camera parallax, which on the PC version is done as you move the mouse around the screen, but we move that onto the tilt of the iPad, so you get kind of a magic window effect. Also, though, making buttons a bit bigger, because if you just took a PC game and put it onto iPads, it would be, well, it was very fiddly when we played with it the first time. Things like that, kind of making the text more readable, doing things that would improve an iPad experience, removing UI elements that, you know, like a scroll bar, which doesn't make sense on an iPad as much as it does on a PC, when you can, you know, you just want to scrub it with your finger. So it was really... It was one of those classic kind of porting processes where it took us about a day to get it running on the iPad and about a month to make it feel good on the iPad.
Right.
So we did it that way, and that's, you know, largely down to the work of a guy called Nick Tringali, who kind of took charge on that version of the game, and it's just lovely. It's really nice.
One of the things that you have to deal with in mobile is obviously the mobile economy. And so there's a lot of free-to-play and all that business that you're kind of butting up against. People can get a little bit testy at the idea of paying for a game, which seems a weird thing to say, but this is the world we're in now. Is mobile a kind of a major platform consideration for you at this point? Or is it one of these things where it's like you design for PC or for consoles, and then if it fits mobile, fine, we'll give it a go. If not, no great shakes.
I think when we're coming up with an idea for a game, we don't necessarily go mobile first. And I think that's, you know, that's something that, you know, a lot of very, very good game studios focus on mobile first, and that's, you know, they do amazing stuff that's very, very popular on the platform, so fair play to them. For us, yeah, there's a reason that not every game we've made has come to mobile. Thomas Was Alone did, with a really good port from Boston Studios. Volume didn't, because Volume is a game that uses most of your keyboard, every button on your controller. it's one of those games. So I think it really comes down on a game-to-game basis. I think our primary kind of audience is, you know, on the PC and console side of things. But, you know, if a game like Subsurface we make and it feels like it's a good fit, and with Subsurface, as I was making it, you know, very much, you know, realized I was making a point-and-click game. And it's like, well, this is exactly the kind of thing I want on iPad. I remember looking for point-and-click adventure games on my iPad a year or two ago, because I enjoyed when I played, so I was looking for more. And there are a lot now, but actually a couple of years ago, that wasn't as well populated. So it felt like something that was kind of a natural kind of game to bring across. So I think we'll do games that fit platform, but I don't think it does a service to the audience, and frankly, you know, won't make its money back to make something that isn't good. We don't want to port things over that won't work. I was very skeptical about Thomas Was Alone for a while, and it actually took Bossa making me a prototype of Thomas Was Alone working on an iPad and me playing it and not hating it, that made me realize, oh, okay, maybe this could work.
It is always weird seeing those games come over. I mean, the Grand Theft Auto games have done, I think, fairly well over on mobile. And as you say, I imagine, like, they put it on there, they put all the touchscreen controls on the screen, and it works, and in the technical sense of it works, but it's not comfortable. It's far from ideal, and it doesn't feel like the right way to play it, because when you look at games that are properly optimized or designed with a platform in mind, and you can think of things like with Her Story came over, and that worked surprisingly well.
Oh, brilliant.
Well,
yeah, you know? Absolutely fantastic. Yeah. And I think that's the thing. I think as those of us who, you know, who are making games kind of more on the console and PC side, I think I really think it's better to bring across maybe half the games we make that will work on the platform. I'd much rather release two games that really work on iPad than all my games on iPad and hate half of them, you know, because it doesn't work.
Finishing up on the narrative thing, I mean, it's always been there. Narrative gaming's never gone away. Like, the text adventure never vanished, but there's been a definite kind of groundswell of support for it, it feels, over the past few years, with things, with, like, Thomas Was Alone being narrative-driven as well as a platformer puzzler, and, you know, her story doing as well as it did. The ones that stick in my head are Story of Edith Finch. What's the full name of that one that slips out of my head? I only played it over Christmas.
Oh, God.
That's terrible of me.
What Remains of Edith Finch.
What Remains, right? There you go. I'm a terrible human being.
Thank you, Kerry.
Yes, thank you, Kerry. And, like, Stories Untold, that little collection of four little horror things, which, again, they were puzzler, but based on a sort of a story, a little mini contained story. These things are getting a decent amount of attention, I think, and capturing people's imaginations, I think, more and more. Plus all the Telltale stuff, which is kind of one of the evolutions or one of the branches off the tree of the narrative adventure, I suppose.
Absolutely.
Where do you think that's come from? Do you think there's been a resurgence, or has it always been there and it's just getting attention now? And where do you think it goes?
I think it's always been there. I think I read an article about saying, you know, story games are dead, I think once a year. It's usually an executive who's trying to sell his new multiplayer game. That's fair enough. I understand why they do that. But I think they're always there. I think one thing that's really helping them right now is price variability, is the fact that, you know, I don't think anyone wants to buy Subsurface Circular for $60. You know, I don't think anyone wants to rush to the shop and buy a boxed kind of text adventure game anymore. That's fair enough. That's fine. So, but I can make a game that kind of comes out, you know, I think kind of around the $5 to $10 mark, which is where most of the games you just listed off are. And obviously on mobile, they're mostly a little bit cheaper again. And I can find an audience who want, you know, a great 2-hour experience. And that kind of that's a massive help to us. And then I think it is just a case of, especially with a mobile audience, just going to that audience and showing them what can be done. You know, because there's this enormous audience, and they are casual in that they, you know, they're not playing console games, they're not kind of hardcore gamers in that kind of traditional stereotypical sense, but they are people who read books and enjoy good TV shows and go to the cinema. You know, they like stories. So if you can kind of go to them and say, well, this is a story that maybe you'll enjoy as much as an episode of Stranger Things, or this is a story that you might like as much as last season of Scandal, you know, just kind of approach them on their own terms and not underestimate them, which is the other big thing with a casual audience, is they're not idiots. They just don't play hardcore games. They enjoy, you know, very mature grown up adult content. You can absolutely go to them and respect their time and their wallets with a lower price and make something that works. And I think that's a lesson that we're slowly but surely learning. I don't think it's a surprise that the stuff that you're listing off there is, you know, character-driven dramas, police procedurals, sci-fi. I mean, this has been the bread and butter of mainstream story entertainment for, you know, as long as I've been alive and much longer. So I think we're working out how to speak to that audience, which is cool for everyone.
And I've already seen that you've mentioned you will be releasing something this year. Is this going to be another in the series of shorts? Is there anything you can tell us?
I can't tell you a single thing, sadly. Ooh. That's a shame, isn't it? I'm as disappointed as you are. no, it is because I'm looking at it on my screen right now. It's really cool, so I want to tell you about it.
Well, we look forward to seeing whatever that is. And thank you so much for coming and talk to us today.
Absolute pleasure.
About this week, we have got, I guess, the biggest release, or the one I've had most fun with so far, is it's actually a board game. It's called Anti-Hero, which is a game that we've got the review up on PG. I've played it for about an hour and a half now, capturing footage for the review and whatnot. You know what? It's good. It's a good little thing. Have you played this one?
I played it in its early stages back in 2016 in the summer, because I was at Gamescom and I had a chat with them versus Evil.
Gotcha.
And they showed me Anti-Hero, and I thought it was just such a cool idea with an almost like Klee-like art style, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's a really nice looking thing. So the way that they've set it up is, it is a game set in, I guess, an old London style. You play as the head of a thief's guild, and the idea is you have to wander about a map. You start in one location. It's all grid-based. There's a fog of war over the map. And the idea is that you have to dive into the houses, uncover the fog of war, and then nick into the buildings and steal stuff. Mm. By stealing stuff, you sort of capture the building, and then you can start getting your guild to take over the entire city. That's the way it works. So as you dive into the house, you rob it, you get some cash. You can then use that cash to hire, for example, street urchins, who you then send in to squat in that building. The more urchins you have in the building, you can have a maximum of 3 in most buildings, you then completely take control and they start generating revenue for you. So you'll get coins, and you also get lanterns, which is another currency you use to buy upgrades. You then start to, you can build thugs, and thugs will, you can stick them outside the houses to protect them. You can combine thugs to gangs, where you get huge groups of them who can wander around taking people out. There is another player on this map. That's the rub of it. It's not just taking over against the city. You're playing against another player who have their own guild, and they are trying to take control of the board as well. So you have to mix your time between trying to conquer and take control of the important buildings in the city, while at the same time fending off attacks from your enemy. They'll come and try and nick your building. They'll come and try and beat on your thugs because they want your property. And likewise, you can go over and try and take their stuff from them. So it's a defense-offense playoff thing. Art style's really nice, like kind of big, bold, cartoony. Reminds me a little bit of Darkest Dungeon, the way it's presented, but it's not a 2D side-scroller. Obviously, it's a isometric, grid-based affair. But the controls are really nice and easy to use. Simple tap stuff. It's quite... They've done the right thing with the UI, where all the icons are big enough that it's comfortable to tap, even on a smaller device. It's very responsive. As Harry says, he gave it a gold award. He's played it longer than me, but I really like what I've played. It does that thing where it is quite simple. They introduce you to the mechanics step by step. They don't do that thing where at the beginning of the game, they tell you every single mechanic in a massive text dump and then say, go.
I hate it when they do that.
Because it's the worst thing, because you get to page 7 and it's like, I can't remember what was on the last 4 pages now, because there is a, you know, finite space. They do the sensible thing where here's one mechanic, here's how you use your main thief. Cool. And then you do a level with that. Great. Now we introduce the idea of bringing urchins in. Cool, do that. Now the thugs. And now the stealth bastards, essentially like little assassin thieves who are silent and can move through the city. So it builds and builds and builds in a way that's genuinely accessible. But at the same time, once you get to later levels, it's tough. Which is good, because it forces you to actually learn and play and finesse your strategy. So read the review, check out the video review, which should be live when you hear this. And Antihero is the name. We think it's really good. Go and have a look. Now, jumping over to the Switch, you had a go on and reviewed Max, The Curse of Brotherhood. What is this? Because I've not heard anything about it, really.
It's like an old Xbox game from 2014, I think.
Oh.
So it's another port, and I think it's pretty much been everywhere. It's like a 2.5-ish D side-scrolling platformer.
Okay.
It's also a puzzler where you've got to try and traverse the environment using a magic pen.
So has it got a little bit of that Scribblenauts thing going on where you're drawing platforms and stuff like that?
A little bit. You're much more limited in that it shows you where you can use your pen by having like this glow over this over different areas, and you can only raise the platform to a certain point.
Mm-hmm.
So rather than like doing it up to the sky or just a tiny bit, you only got a finite amount of magic to use.
Got you.
Per area. But it's good. It's entertaining. It's aged, evidently. But it's still, you know, it's still good. And it works really well on the Switch. It fits it very comfortably.
Mm-hmm.
Which is quite nice. But yeah,
comes to the drawing stuff, does it take advantage of the touchscreen, or are you just using sticks still?
Well, fun enough, it does take advantage of the touchscreen, given, you know, the mechanics and things.
Yeah.
But I didn't realise that you could do it on the touchscreen, so I originally was doing it with my controller. And even the controllers actually were very comfortable to use, because usually you've got that thing, you know, it goes absolutely all over the place, and it's really difficult to try and manoeuvre it.
No, and presumably because it was created for Xbox or whatever in the first place, so it's optimised for joypads anyway. Like, that's how it was made. So the touchscreen bit's just a bonus.
Yeah, exactly. But it's nice. It gives you that option, and it feels very, very comfortable on handheld systems, as in, like, rather than using the dock.
But broadly, you gave it a bronze and said it's, you know, if you've played it already, it's probably not necessarily worth getting again. but it still kind of has enough just about to recommend it if you're a platformy fan.
Yeah, and it's not horrendously expensive. It's not bad. It's just one of those sort of mediocre games which is all right to play if you've got a few minutes spare.
Fair enough. All right, then. So Max, The Curse of the Brotherhood, that's available for Switch at the minute. Hopping back onto mobile, we've got Sharado, which is a game that has clearly cribbed quite heavily from the Infinity Blade camp, but instead of the swipe-based combat, it's going for precision tapping instead and sticking the whole thing in a massive magical samurai garb. So I have been unable to play it because the device I have access to at the minute, at least the iOS one, can't run it. The Android one can, but it's a relatively new one. So if you've got an iPhone 6 still from 2013 or whenever it is, it won't run it, by the way. Well, even though it says it will run it on the App Store. It says that, Emily, but it's lying.
Don't believe it. It's time to get a new device, James.
It's not my fault. It's the company's device. But the game itself has that Infinity Blade thing where you are sprinting between different encounters. So you start off fighting a dude. It goes into a standard, like, you know, one-on-one brawl in your classic Street Fighter style. You have to do taps at the right times in order to make attacks, double tapping things to execute special attacks. There's a stamina bar, which you've got to keep an eye on. You can't just keep battering away willy-nilly because you will run out of samurai puff. And then once you've taken that dude out, you kind of just sprint over to the next bit of the map where there is another encounter, and on and on and on you go. We've reviewed this one as well. I think John Monday just put up the review for it, and he gave it a bronze. It's got that kind of, he says, like, slightly Dead Souls-y, Dark Souls-y death system, where when you die, you end up dropping all of your cash on that level that you were defeated, and then you need to fight your way all the way back to it. So it's trying to be a little bit more hardcore than something like Infinity Blade, a little bit less cash. But the place where it doesn't work, apparently, is variety, because everyone kind of looks the same, the environments kind of look the same, and it can feel even more grindy than Infinity Blade can.
So that's a shame.
Yeah, that's the down bit. But apparently it looks good. If you've got an iPhone 8 or an X or something, then it looks the business, so it's good to show off to people. But it might grow a bit stale after a while once you've seen everything it's got to show you. But it's worth a try still. So Sharado is the name of that one. A few bonus things that also came out this week. So you've got The Dresden Files, which is a card-based game. This is one I haven't played, but we're going to be reviewing that very soon. So have a look at that. I think it's a murder mystery-style thing, but keep your eyes peeled for more information. We've got Abbey Light RC Club, which is one of those augmented reality-style apps where you basically get to race a little RC car around your home or your park or your, let's be honest, toilet. wherever you play games, you get to trundle them around there. So that's maybe worth a look if you're into the AR stuff. And also we have Heroes Second Memory, which I have been reliably informed is Bobbins.
It's fine. That's like the top thing that I'll say about it.
That's as far as you're willing to go. It's a sort of single screen shmup, where instead of you being scrolling up the screen all the time, you take control of a little fantasy hero dude, and you are just scrolling around the screen, constantly firing at enemies which are coming at you from the top of the screen. You're not actually moving up the screen, it's just there, static. But then you're getting skeletons and all manner of fantasy beasties who look quite cute, some of them, and like they don't. I don't know why I'm killing them. And while your ranger is firing plasma bolts like they're in Dodonpachi. It's a bit weird, it's a bit muddled. And also there are robots. What is this game? This is so weird.
I don't know.
It's like every genre and every style of, let's call it, steampunk and fantasy and sci-fi and, it looks a bit confused. I don't know. I haven't played it. Maybe it's amazing. Heroes Second Memory is the name of the game. That'll do for the first show of 2018. We want to mention that we've discovered that we're getting so many downloads that the bandwidth is breaking our server for the podcast.
Yeah, so that's always fun.
Which we literally found out just before we started recording. So thanks, and also stop it.
But don't.
Don't stop it, because I love the idea that there are so many people listening that it's breaking our servers. But that's great. Brilliant. Thank you. If you're new to the show and are still listening now, then awesome. We mentioned we'd seen an uptick, but we didn't realise it was quite this much of an uptick in listeners. So we're really pleased. Thank you for listening. That's also great. If you fancy liking and subscribing and all of that stuff, then that's even better. But if you don't, we understand, because using iTunes sucks. So join us next week. We'll have more news, more interviews, and more mobile goodies for you then. And in the meantime, go play a good game. We'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
See ya.